Record on this computer. Okay, great. And now I'm just going to share the source sheet. Okay. So as I said before, the past few weeks we've been talking about the first paradigm about the forefathers keeping certain mitzvos. Yaakov marrying two sisters, where he seems to have violated it. This week we're going to be talking about the second row, where the avos needed to not fulfill or to violate a certain mitzvah, namely Shabbos. As we'll see later in depth, non-Jews are not allowed to keep Shabbos. Why is an interesting question. Hopefully we'll deal with it. But just to keep in mind right now, a non-Jewish person is forbidden to keep Shabbos. And not only that, as we'll see, they're actually forbidden to keep any day of rest the way Jews do. And so if we say that the avos, if we say that the forefathers were not Jewish, then how could we say that they kept all of the mitzvos? They obviously could not have kept Shabbos. They were not allowed to keep Shabbos. So the way we'll approach this question is actually by reading a tshuva, a halachic responsa from the mid-1800s. Now, you might think that this question that we're dealing with is a very antiquated, purely theoretical, conceptual, intellectual question that we might be just interested or curious to deal with, but it actually has a very significant halachic ramification to this very day. The first time it was raised in earnest was in the year 1848-1849 in Yerushalayim. It was a major halachic controversy. Maybe controversy is a little strong of a word. It wasn't really a fight, but it was a major halachic discussion that was published in many journals throughout the world. And as we'll see, there's been a very recent historical reevaluation of the incident based on some contemporary evidence that was found only a few years ago, probably within the last 5-10 years. So just to sort of set the stage, I want you to go back in your mind to when you were children and you went to school. And every once in a while, the teacher would either be out sick or wouldn't be able to make it in for the day. And you had a substitute teacher. Now, that substitute teacher probably gave us all work. I remember that. They would give us work, but it wasn't really meant to teach us anything. It was more just meant to be busy work. And the rationale behind that is when the main person in charge goes away, whether it be in a school, in a work environment, or in a family environment, and you put somebody else in charge. You obviously want them to be responsible. You want them to sort of further whatever goals you have set for the people or the organization you're looking after or you're in charge of. But the primary concern, if we're perfectly honest, is that you just want the person to cause the least amount of damage while you're away. You don't want to come back and to see everything thrown into chaos. And that's what pretty much happened in Yerushalayim in 1848. During the 1800s, there was a relatively large influx. It wasn't so large at the time. It would be much larger towards the end of the 19th century with the first Aliyah movement. But the Yishuv Hayashan, the old settlement of Jews, the Sephardi community as well as the Ashkenazi community that had moved in after the death of the Baal Shem Tov and the Vilna Gaon in the early 1800s, there was a slow trickle of Jews that moved into Yerushalayim, and there was both an Ashkenazi and a Sephardi community. They were extremely poor. Food was not so, food was expensive, food was not readily accessible. There was disease. There wasn't a lot of Jewish infrastructure. In fact, the reason why Shaarei Tzedek was built, the hospital Shaarei Tzedek, now it's a huge religiously run hospital. The reason why it was originally built was because the only genuine available healthcare that was of some, you know, normal normative standard for the time were run by Christian missionaries and nuns. And you knew that when you checked into the hospital, they would try to convert you to Judaism. And that was one of the reasons why they built Shaarei Tzedek. The Jews had very little money, and the primary source of income that they were able to get, they couldn't really work the land all that much around Yerushalayim, wasn't much business. So the primary source of income was to send out a rabbi, to send out a shliach, a messenger, to the diaspora and to raise money. And they would be gone for usually several years at a time, sometimes more, sometimes less. And they would raise money throughout Europe, throughout North Africa, throughout some parts of Asia, to bring back money to support the community. So the head of the Ashkenazi community at the time, his name was Rabbi Shmuel Salant, and he went on one of these trips. So the chief rabbi, as it were, of the Ashkenazi community, the head of the Ashkenazi community, wasn't around. And when before he left, he appointed a Rav, a Talmud Chacham. His name was Rabbi Asher Lemel. Rabbi Asher Lemel, I don't know so much about him. He was an Ashkenazi. He grew up in Europe. I believe previously he was a Rav in St. Gallen's in modern-day Switzerland. And he was in charge of the Ashkenazi community. And on the 23rd of Adar, Sheni, in the year 1848, remember that date because it'll come back at the end of this year when we try to reevaluate it using contemporary historical findings. But in 1848, shortly after Purim, a shaila, a halachic question came before him. So let's look at source number one. This is a responsa of Rabbi Asher Lemel, sort of post facto justifying his position. He says, Yomedenu Rabbeinu, he's writing to another rabbi who we'll talk about a little bit later, but he said, teach me. Ba'uvda da'asan lidan. A certain incident came about here. Po ir hakodesh Yerushalayim, in the holy city of Yerushalayim, Yom Gimel, a Tuesday, Chaf Gimel Liyerech Adar Sheni, the 23rd of Adar Sheni, Shnas Tafresh Ches, the year 1848. Ha'avar Nimol Eino Yehudi Echad, Sheba Hine Mimedinas Morocco, L'shem Geirus Bifanenu, based in Sedek, the Kahal Ashkenazim. So a non-Jewish person came before the Ashkenazi based in, and this convert, or this non-Jew, was originally from Morocco. He circumcised himself for the purpose of converting to Judaism before the Jewish court. V'kibel alav hamitzvos kedin uchetorah hakadosha, and he accepted upon himself the mitzvos. He wanted to be Jewish, and as we know, there are two or three steps to becoming a Jew once the Torah was given. The first two, everybody has to do. The first two, one has to accept upon themselves all of the mitzvos, and in addition to that, to accept upon themselves the fate of the Jewish people, just like Rus did in the Megillah that we read on Shavuos. We heard some people heard it before Shavuos, some people read it by themselves over Shavuos. But Rus said, I will follow you, Naomi, my mother-in-law, wherever you go. Your God, meaning religion, will be my religion, and your people, their fate, will also be my people. So that's one acceptance that you need. Another thing that a person needs before they convert is to go to the mikveh, to immerse themselves. The third, if you're a male, you need to be circumcised. So this person, this Jewish man from Morocco, ostensibly, did two out of three. He circumcised himself, and he accepted all of the mitzvos. U'bishabbos kodesh shel acharav, and apparently this was done during the week, and then Shabbos came around, Adayin lo hayin nisrafe, he hadn't fully recovered from his circumcision, mimi lasso, velo tava lo dena, and they didn't want it to get infected, wasn't healthy, so he hadn't gone yet to the mikvah. So if it were you or me, I would say, okay, he's not Jewish yet. He's two-thirds of the way there. So he giduli, so this happened on Shabbos. So some messengers told him, mizrizaso b'mitzvos, for his great zeal for mitzvos, Echu nizhar b'shvisas Shabbos. He was very scrupulous about keeping Shabbos. Hagam shehu odenu b'chlal chole she'en bo sakana. Even though the halacha says that somebody who has just been circumcised within a few days of their circumcision, they're considered to be a sick person who's not in mortal danger. And so even though normally you're not allowed to tell a non-Jew to do malacha, to do work that is forbidden on Shabbos for you, our sages said that if a person is sick, even if they're not in mortal danger, you're allowed to tell a non-Jew to do work for you. So this person who's recovering from their circumcision, they're considered to be a non-mortally ill sick person. And therefore, he would be allowed to tell a non-Jew to do stuff. But nevertheless, he didn't want to. It was still the winter. They were cold. He needed some warmth. And he forbade a goy to light a fire in his house. So the people that had come to tell the rabbi, they said, listen, you know, we just visited this convert. He's not doing too well, and he's refusing to get medical care to help him. So can you essentially tell him that he's allowed to tell a non-Jew to light a fire to keep him warm? And so Rav Asher Lemel responded that he's allowed to do it himself. He's not Jewish yet. And so as long as he hasn't immersed himself yet in the mikvah, he is allowed to do work on Shabbos. But then he took it even a step further. He says he's not only mutter, it's not only permitted for him to do it, he's actually obligated to do it. He must do work. Because before he immerses himself in a mikvah, he's not Jewish, and therefore he is forbidden to keep Shabbos, as we'll see the source for that in a moment. But he said it is actually forbidden for him to keep Shabbos. V'ko asu hashomim lema ashma'atai. So, you know, he's the interim chief rabbi. He's the substitute chief rabbi. So when the chief rabbi tells you something, you have to follow it. So these messengers went back to this convert. V'holchu etzel hager. They went to this guy. V'higidu lo b'shmi kein b'shabbos kodesh la'achar tfilas mincha. So this had happened towards the end of Shabbos, it was already mincha time. So they came to him and they said, listen, the rabbi says, before sunsets, you got to violate Shabbos. V'chein asa ki kasav eza osios. And so the guy complied and he wrote a few words down. Now we know from another source, there are multiple accounts. Basically, after this whole debate erupted, there were multiple accounts of what happened. So in another account, it actually says that this guy had been keeping Shabbos for many months already, and he was so distraught, he listened, because that's what the rabbi told him to do, but he was crying as he violated Shabbos. But he did it. He wrote some words down, he wrote his name, so he violated Shabbos. Vayehi biyom hamacharas, and it was on the morrow, on Sunday morning, Kasher nishma hadavar. See, nowadays, everything would be instantaneous with social media. You're saying, hey, you know what the rabbi just said? I just saw some messengers going over to this guy's house. He needs to violate Shabbos. Nowadays, it took a couple of hours. It took one news cycle, so to speak, for the events to spread around the shtetl of Yerushalayim at the time. But kasher nishma hadavar bi'ir hakodesh. So at the time when the news spread about what had happened here in the holy city, savchu alai chachmei Sfarad v'chachmei Ashkenazim, there was this universal condemnation of his actions. Both the Sfardic and the Ashkenazic sages of the time in Yerushalayim, they criticized Rav Asher Lemel for his decision. Al davar chadish halozu asher lo nishma meolam, on this new innovation that Rav Asher Lemel had ordered that had never been heard about in their memory. They had remembered many converts in the past that had been done in Yerushalayim itself, and they had never heard of this idea. If somebody gets circumcised later on in life, it's painful, it takes a little bit longer to heal, and so it might take them a couple of days or perhaps even a week before they're able to go into the mikvah. So this was not the first time that something like this had happened. And yet, nevertheless, they had never heard of somebody that once they were circumcised and accept mitzvos, just because they hadn't gone into the mikvah, that they would have to violate Shabbos. Uminayin li lechadesh davar asher lo sha'arim harishonim. And there's no source for this. So they were saying, how could you have the gall to innovate something? And so he's writing to this more senior rabbi, I responded to basically give me a little bit of breathing room. Maybe I can try to reinforce my position through this letter. And I'm going to spell out my reasoning. He said, granted, in retrospect, I should have consulted with all of the other sages and rabbis in Yerushalayim at the time, terem na'aseh ha'maisa, before I made this halachic decision. Amnam, however, he says, machmas ki kvar haya achar tfilas mincha le'es erev. Shabbos was almost over, and if in fact it is forbidden for a non-Jew to keep Shabbos, this potential convert would need to violate Shabbos very quickly. Uvein kach yatzeh Shabbos kodesh, and you know, Shabbos was almost over. Uve'enai hadavar hayapashut she'en kan iser klal. And it was so obvious to me that there was no problem with what I was saying, it didn't dawn on me to ask anybody. So then he goes on to explain his rationale for why he thought the not yet convert would still need to violate Shabbos. So let's look at the sources. The bottom of page 2, in source number 2, we have a pasuk, we have a verse from Parshas Noach. If anybody had taken a look at the end of the sheet I had sent out for Shavuos in the Lincoln Square Synagogue packet, I referenced this pasuk. I referenced this verse for another purpose, sort of the transition between the pre-flood and post-flood, about the change of seasons. The pasuk says, "Od kol yumei ha'aretz zera v'katzir v'chom v'kayetz." V'choref, v'yom, v'layla lo yishbosu. So long as the earth endures, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter, day and night shall not cease. So the way some commentaries explain is that before the flood, there had been no seasons. It had always just been this almost utopian type of existence. And the convulsions of the flood, the tremendous forces that were unleashed during the time of the Great Flood, actually caused the Earth's axis to shift to its present form, which created seasons. So that's what the Sifarno, he's a medieval commentator, and then the Malbim, much more modern one, discuss. There's actually some contemporary evidence on a much smaller scale, obviously, after the earthquake in Japan about 10 years ago. The earth axis also shifted even much more slightly. So that's what this pasuk is talking about. God is essentially telling Noach that there's going to be some changes after the flood. Up until this point, humanity had it easy. It was very easy for them. Almost all of their needs were taken care of. They didn't need to work so hard. And because of that, all of their abundance of free time and resources led them to sin. And so Hashem said, now life is going to be a little bit harder. There's going to be seasons, and day and night, the universe will continue. And so if we look at the end, the last words, the last four words of the verse, V'yom v'layla lo yishbosu, day and night, it shall not cease. Now, the simple interpretation of those four words is that it's going back to the rest of the verse. Essentially, all of the temporal natural cycles in the world, day and night, spring, fall, winter, summer, all of those forces, all of those phenomena, all of those natural functioning of the world will not stop like it did during the flood. However, the Gemara in source number 3 in Sanhedrin says that it's not only referring to the natural phenomenon of the world, but it's actually referring to humanity itself. That humanity itself will not be able to rest. That inbred now, you know, inbred in the human psyche will be this need to work, this need to constantly produce that will preoccupy us. And God's hope is that it will deter us from sinning as much as we did beforehand. So in source number 3, the Gemara in Sanhedrin says, V'omar Reish Lakish said, Oved kochavim sheshavas chayiv misa. A Gentile who rests on Shabbos is liable for the death penalty. Shenemar v'yom v'layla lo yishbosu. Day and night they shall not rest. V'omar mar az harasan shelehen zuhi misasan. We have a rule that even though there are no punishments in the Torah for Gentiles for violating their mitzvos, nevertheless, the fact that it says that it's forbidden has an implied death penalty. So therefore, because there is this obligation for humanity to work, and it's almost this chiddush, it is an innovation, it is a gift that God told the Jewish people that once a week you don't have to work. One day a week you can rest. It's the beauty of Shabbos that the norm for humanity is that we need to work. And God gives us the ability and the power and the gift to be able to take one day off and rest. But for all other human beings, they are not allowed to rest like the Jews do on Shabbos. And Omar Ravina, afilu sheni b'Shabbos. Ravina says, not even if they don't rest on Shabbos, but let's say on Sunday or Friday, like in other religions. Even then, even though they're not resting on Shabbos, the fact that they rested on a different day like the Jews do on Shabbos is also forbidden. Now, just to clarify, when it says Chayiv Misa, it doesn't, according to some commentaries, mean literally that you get the death penalty. Some commentaries say that you do, that if theoretically the Jewish people were in charge, anybody who keeps Shabbos, any non-Jew who keeps Shabbos would get the death penalty. But many other commentaries say no, it means that you're chayev misa bidei shamayim, that you deserve the death penalty, heaven might punish you, but humanity can't give you the death penalty for keeping Shabbos, just to clarify that. But regardless of how you interpret whether there's a literal punishment or not, the Gemara says that it is forbidden for a non-Jew to keep Shabbos. Okay, so now what is the definition of a non-Jew? What is the definition of a convert? How do we know when a person stops being a non-Jew and becomes a Jewish person? So in source number 4, there's a Gemara in Yevamos. The Gemara in Yevamos says, "De'amar Reb Chiya bar Abba, amar Reb Yochanan, le'olam ein ger ad sheyimol v'yitbol." That a person is not a convert until he has been circumcised and immersed. Now the story that this Gemara is talking about, it's a rather interesting story. Very similar to our case, that this Amora, this Gemara, Talmudic era sage had visited a town, and he found that there were some people that were in the midst of a conversion process. I believe that they had been circumcised, but not yet gone to the mikvah, just like our potential convert seems to have done. And they married Jewish women. And so the question was, are these kids Jewish? Are their children Jewish? Or do they need a conversion? Now we know that Jewish status follows the mother. But there are other opinions that it might not be so straightforward. So that's what the case is of that Gemara, but the maskana, the consensus at the end of the sugya, at the end of the section, is that a person does not become a convert until they have been circumcised and immersed. V'kevan de lo tavil oved kochavim hu. And until the person has not yet immersed, he is still considered a Gentile. He is still considered not Jewish. And so Rav Asher Lemuel said, listen, we know that it's forbidden for a non-Jew to keep Shabbos. And based off of this Gemara, a person who hasn't yet immersed, even if they've accepted the mitzvos, even if they've been circumcised, nevertheless, they're still not Jewish. So he said, it was so obvious to me that I didn't even bother to ask anybody else, just because it seemed like there was absolutely no problem. It was so simple what I was saying. But everybody else seems to disagree. And they didn't necessarily, at their first knee-jerk reaction was not to provide sources against Rav Asher Lemuel, but rather just to say that's not how it's ever been done. We've never heard of this before. And that actually seems to be the primary argument against Rav Asher Lemuel, that historically this has never been the case. So now let's try to hear some answers or some response to Rav Asher Lemuel. Rav Asher Lemuel had written his responsa to the Binyan Sion. If you look on the bottom of page number 3, source number 5, there's a picture of the Binyan Sion. His name was Rav Yaakov Etlinger. He was one of the Gedolei Hadar, one of the greatest rabbis of his era. He also lived in Germany, in the Altona region. And he was a massive sage. He got questions from throughout the world. And he sort of fielded this controversy after it had erupted in Yerushalayim. It took over a year for this to occur, for the letters to go back and forth. As you see at the top of source number 5, this is from 26th of Iyar, 1849. So already almost a year had passed, just things moved a lot lot slower back then. But now he's responding to Rav Asher Lemel, trying to mediate the different sides of the argument. So Altona, Friday, 26th of ER 1849, to the great Rabbi Asher Lemel, former chief dayan in Galen and presently in the holy city of Jerusalem. So this is what Rav Yaakov Etlinger says. Chikarti bishar mekomos shemekablim gerim. I did some homework, I did my research throughout other areas that accepted Jewish converts. Now, converting to Judaism at that time was a very rare phenomenon. Most people did not want to join the Jewish people, and in fact, at that time, this was sort of the beginning of the Reform movement. Both before and after the onset of the Reform movement in Europe, especially in Central and Western Europe, and Rav Yaakov Etlinger lived in Central Europe. He was the Rebbe of Rav Shimshon Raphael Hirsch. So he actually, Rav Yaakov Etlinger was a very interesting person. He was one of the first Frum rabbis to also go to university. I don't think he got his degree. I don't think he got a doctorate or any formal degree, but he spent some time studying philosophy in secular university. And nevertheless, he came out Frum, completely Orthodox, and a very strong opponent against any reform. But he was one of the trailblazers of people sort of combining a yeshiva education and then going to university. So at that time, many people were leaving Judaism and converting to Christianity to better their socioeconomic position in society. So he probably had to look pretty hard to find out what other communities were doing. He says, Chakarti bishar makomos shemekablim gerim. I researched other places that accept converts. V'nemar li shagam sham me'olam lo hikpidu al zeh, shelo yishmar hager shabbos kodem hatvila. Said none of them ever said that they ever were makpid, that they ever insisted that somebody that hadn't yet immersed themselves would have to violate Shabbos. V'nasati el libi limtso tam lo zeh. And I endeavored to find a rationale for that. Achar shelechora psak malek kvod toraso miyusar al adnei hadin ve'emes. And he said, I've had to work really hard to try to find a rationale for this phenomenon because Rav Asher Lemel, based on what you've presented, it's a very compelling argument that you make. It really makes sense and true what you're saying, but re'isi shehadim in haminhag. He said, that's just not the way it is. Throughout the world, nobody says that once you've been circumcised, once you've accepted mitzvos, even though you have not become a full-fledged Jew, nevertheless, you do not have to violate Shabbos. So what's the rationale? And so he gives a reason. He says, "Dekvar mitzad hasvara yiyeh misnaged el haseichel." It would be counterintuitive just from a logical perspective. Acharei shemilas hager nikra bris, shemevarchem aleha kores habris. He says circumcision is called a covenant, a bris. That's why we call it bris mila. That comes from the bracha that we make, kores habris, that when we make a circumcision, we thank Hashem for giving us the gift of creating a covenant with him. Vigam Shabbos nikra bris, and also Shabbos is called a covenant. And so therefore, eich nemar, achar shenichnis labris ha'achas, yihye muchruch, lahafer bris acheres shakadosh hakadosh baruch hu im Yisrael mekayme mitzvosav. And so he says, it doesn't make sense that once a person has accepted one covenant on themselves, they should have to violate and profane another covenant that God had made with the Jewish people. So once you have entered the covenant of circumcision, it doesn't make sense that you'd have to violate a different covenant, namely Shabbos. Then he continues, and he says, "V'hine b'Shabbos, in Tractate Shabbos, Amrinan, da'al Shabbos nitztavu Yisrael b'mara." So now he tries to bring a proof to his argument that even though you're not a full-fledged Jew yet, nevertheless, you've sort of entered the middle stage of having a covenant with God, and therefore you can't violate any other covenants. And so he says, there's a Gemara in Shabbos, which tells us that the Jewish people were commanded, or were first commanded about the mitzvah of Shabbos in Mara. In Parshas B'Shalach, after the Jewish people crossed the Yam Suf, crossed through the Red Sea, they walked 3 days, they didn't have any water, and God made a miracle that the bitter water that they found turned sweet. And at that juncture, before they got to Har Sinai, it says, Sam lo chok u'mishpat. Shamsam lo chok u'mishpat. That God gave them laws. God taught them certain mitzvos at that time. And the Gemara says that this is a reference to Shabbos. So the Jewish people got the mitzvah of Shabbos even before the Torah was given, even before Har Sinai. V'chein muchach mehaksuvim. Shekvar kaimu Yisrael Shabbos kodem shebo lahar Sinai. And it's clear from the text that the Jewish people kept Shabbos before they got to Har Sinai. So what? He continues, v'kevan detvila lohaya ad Sinai. Since the only textual evidence that we had that the Jewish people immersed themselves is immediately before Har Sinai, and in fact that's where we learn that a convert needs to immerse themselves. Al karchach kaimu Yisrael Shabbos kishemalu velo tavlu, af shebnei Noach muzhar al yom velayla lo yishbosu. So he says, if you put all of these different pieces together, what emerges is that the Jewish people kept Shabbos after they did circumcision in Egypt, but before they immersed themselves and got the Torah, even though that other non-Jews at the time were forbidden to keep Shabbos because of the verse from Noach of day and night they shall not rest. Ve'al kein sarach lomar, o shegzeres hakasuv haya, either that, you know, there was just some explicit ruling in the Torah that said that you still have to keep Shabbos. Shele'inyan Shabbos yatsu michlal b'nei Noach v'neilef misham. So you could just say that there was a textual exception when God commanded them to keep Shabbos, that he says, even though technically you're not Jewish yet, you still have to keep Shabbos. Oh, or alternatively, perhaps the more logical one, ka'asher kasavnu, just as I've written earlier, she'al yidei she'nichnesu libris mila, nichnesu gamken libris Shabbos. So Shabbos in itself might not be an exception to the rule, in as much that it's indicative of an intermediary stage that the Jewish people had reached. They were no longer Gentiles. They weren't yet Jews. And in fact, they were this sort of middle category of bris. They just merely had a covenant with God, and therefore anything that's connected to covenant needs to be observed, namely Shabbos. And so what Rav Yaakov Ettlinger was responding to Rav Asher Lemel is that, well, if you just look at the Gemaras, you seem to be right. But clearly the practice is not like that. And the only rationale that I could say to explain this phenomenon is just like the Jews before Har Sinai kept Shabbos, because they have entered into this middle stage of a relationship with God, so too, even once the Torah was given, a convert that hasn't done the final step but has entered into a covenant still needs to keep mitzvahs that are relevant to a covenant. So that's sort of the argument against Rav Asher Lemel. And in fact, while it really gained prominence during this controversy, there's actually somebody much earlier who advanced a very similar position. It's probably not identical, as we'll see, but it's very similar. If you look in source number 6, there's a Gemara in Yevamos. The Gemara in Yevamos says, "V'Rabbi Akiva, hai toshav v'sachir mai avidle." So this is talking about the laws of the Pesach sacrifice. Who's allowed to partake from a Pesach sacrifice? Who's not allowed to partake from a Pesach sacrifice? And so there's a certain phrase in the verse that we're trying to explain, toshav v'sachir, that it's saying that these people can't, a toshav, a sojourner, and a sachir, a person that's sort of renting property but isn't Jewish, they're not allowed to partake in the Pesach sacrifice. Only Jewish people are. So that phrase seems to be extra for some technical reasons. So we ask, according to Rabbi Akiva, what are these words trying to teach us? And the Gemara says, dafka specifically our case, la'asuye ger shemol velo tava. It's coming to say that a convert who has circumcised himself but has not yet immersed himself, literally just like our case, he is not allowed to eat the Pesach sacrifice. So at first glance, that seems to support what Rav Asher Lemel was saying. The guy's not Jewish yet, so therefore he's not allowed to eat from the Karban Pesach. He's not allowed to eat from the Pesach sacrifice. So similarly, he's not allowed to keep Shabbos. But that's actually, it actually has a very big question. The Rashba in source number 7, a medieval commentary, we referenced him last week about sort of the mystical interpretation of the Avos, of the forefathers, choosing or not choosing to keep mitzvot. So on his commentary to Yevamos, he asks a very strong question. He says, Kashali, Imkein hainu akum. Said, according to this Gemara, what this pasuk, what this verse is trying to teach us, is that a non-Jew is not allowed to eat the Karban Pesach. Va'afal pi shemal, and even though he is circumcised, and the Torah says somebody who's not circumcised is not allowed to eat the Karban Pesach, implying that somebody who does have a bris is allowed to, that's only if you're a Jewish person that's circumcised. But this person is not yet Jewish. Harehu ka'arel, dehavale ka'aravi mahu. He brings a proof. He says, Arabs, the descendants of Yishmael, Avraham's son, also are obligated in circumcision. Slightly different than the way Jews do it, but they are also obligated, according to many, to circumcise themselves to this day. And in fact, devout Muslims do. But nobody says that they're allowed to eat from the Karban Pesach, because even though they're circumcised, they didn't circumcise themselves as Jews, they circumcised themselves as Arabs or Muslims. And so even though they're obligated to do that, that still doesn't give them the right to eat from the Karban Pesach. And so the Rashba asks, so what on earth is the Torah trying to teach? What on earth is the Gemara trying to teach us? We already know that. We already know. The Torah already said that somebody who is not halachically Jewishly circumcised or Jewish yet is not allowed to eat from the Karban Pesach. So why on earth would I think that this middle case, our convert case, somebody who has circumcised but has not completed the conversion process would be any different? The guy's not Jewish yet. And the Rashba answers and he says, no. Dishani hacha, this case is different from the standard non-Jewish circumcision case. Unlike the Arabs who circumcised because they're Arabs, he says here, demilaso l'shem yahadus. Here, this guy circumcised as part of his conversion process to Judaism. Va'afal pi shelo nigmar geruso. And even though his conversion process was not yet complete, mikol makom kvar hischil v'nichnas k'tzas bidas yehudis she'eno tzarech tvila. And so he says, nevertheless, since he's initiated the Jewish process, he's entered into Judaism a little bit in as manifested by the fact that he only needs to do an immersion in the mikvah to complete the process. So the Rashba is actually saying something very similar to what Rav Yaakov Ettlinger was saying. The Rashba phrases it slightly differently, but what essentially he's saying is that even though he's not fully Jewish yet, he's reached this intermediary stage, which for Karban Pesach is not sufficient, but for other areas, that might count for something, namely Shabbos. So Rav Shmuel Salant, when he returned back to Yerushalayim and he sort of found the mess that had erupted while he left, this is what he responded. He said, from this Rashba, you see that even though for Karban Pesach, this intermediary stage is not enough, it still counts for something. And that's why this convert, this Moroccan convert, should not be allowed to violate Shabbos. He should be obligated to keep Shabbos. And in source number 8, he continues, I'll say this I'll say this outside, but Reb Shmuel Salant took this even one step further just to sort of explain the two-step process. He says, up until the actual immersion in the mikvah, until a person goes into the mikvah to convert, they're allowed to go back. They're allowed to repudiate their acceptance of mitzvos. They're allowed to say, I don't want this anymore. I don't want to be Jewish. Once they go into the mikvah, there's no turning back. But before that point, you're allowed to say, I don't want to be Jewish anymore. And so this dynamic that Reb Shmuel Salant says, that's his picture in source number 8, he says that up until the point of once the person is circumcised, they're considered Jewish. But they're allowed to repudiate it. They're allowed to recant their acceptance of their Judaism. And once they go into the mikvah, then their Jewish status is conferred retroactively. So therefore, one does not need to violate and in fact keep Shabbos for two reasons. First of all, he says, because the person is retroactively Jewish from the time of circumcision. And second of all, he says, if you are mechallel Shabbos, if you do desecrate Shabbos at that point, like this convert was told to do, that might actually constitute a repudiation of the acceptance of Judaism that you did when you circumcised yourself. You said at the time of circumcision you wanted to be Jewish, and now you're violating Shabbos. So this seems to be a very cogent argument against Rav Asher Lemel. Now, Rav Asher Lemel responded, as you see in source number 9, I wasn't able to find where he said this explicitly. I found this secondhand in the work Contemporary Halachic Problems by Rabbi Dr. J.D. Bleich. He says, Rashba's comment did not go unnoticed by Rav Asher Lemel. And he, in fact, quotes this Rashba, but regards it as merely an analysis of the provision of Jewish law that would have been applicable in the absence of a verse designed to include the unimmersed convert from partaking of the Paschal offering. Now, just to summarize what he said, that pasuk, that Gemara that we spoke about from Rabbi Akiva in source number 6, of Toshav Visachir, that it's coming to say that our case, a convert that has been circumcised but not immersed, they're not allowed to partake in the Pesach sacrifice. So Rav Asher Lemel says, it doesn't mean that the Pesach sacrifice is unique. It means that in all categories, he's still considered not a Jew. I might think he's Jewish, as the Rashba says, because he's halfway there. But what the Gemara is telling us is that it's not true. It's either all or nothing. And what Rav Shmuel Salant says, no, that's a specific halacha for Pesach sacrifice, that it's all or nothing. But for everything else, including Shabbos, it's not all or nothing. There is a notion of being halfway. And this convert from Morocco was halfway, and therefore he would need to keep Shabbos. So that's sort of the debate that happened or that had erupted during that time. Now, how does this connect to the Avos? How does this connect to the forefathers? We began this class by saying that Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov ostensibly kept all of the Torah mitzvahs according to the Gemara, according to many Midrashim. They kept all of the Torah even before it was given. Now, that opened up a big problem for us. If they weren't Jewish, how were they allowed to keep Shabbos? So perhaps we can begin to answer that question based on what we have just answered. Avraham, Yitzchak, Yaakov, and all of their children were circumcised. They all had bris milah. And so one could say that in fact, even though they weren't completely Jewish, because they had entered into this covenant, according to Rav Yaakov Ettlinger, they had been nichnas lebris, they had entered into the covenant, so they were now also able to fulfill other commandments, other mitzvos that are connected to being in a covenant with God, namely Shabbos. So it's very possible that the Avos kept Shabbos halachically because they had bris milah, and therefore their entire family, even though they weren't fully Jewish, were not Gentiles either. But in fact, there's actually an even simpler answer, similar, but actually Even Rav Asher Lemel would agree to this potential. Let's see source number 10. The Rambam, in the Laws of Kings, talks about the Sheva Mitzvahs B'nai Noach, talks about halachos that pertain to non-Jews. So he says at the end of the first line, V'chein akum sheshovas afilu biyom miyamos hachol, and even if a non-Jew keeps Shabbos sometime during the week, not even specifically on Shabbos himself, im asa'uhu la'atzmo kimo Shabbos, if he treated it like Shabbos, chayav misa, he is obligated, he receives the death penalty. Ve'in tzarech lomar im asa moed la'atzmo, and obviously if he kept a yontif, if he made it as a yontif for himself. Klalel shel davar, this is the general rule, ein manichin osan lechadesh das. We do not allow non-Jews to innovate even genuine religious observances for themselves. Either accept all of the mitzvos as a Jew, or you keep the Sheva mitzvos b'nei Noach, you keep the seven Noahide laws, don't keep Shabbos. There's no middle ground. You're either a Jew where you have to keep everything, or you're a non-Jew and you only keep the mitzvahs that you are obligated in, but you can't voluntarily take on other things. The im asak b'torah o shavas o chidesh davar, but if a non-Jew does any of these things, makinoso va'onshinoso, we punish them, umodiyinoso shehu chayav mis, and we tell him that he's liable for the death penalty, but we don't actually execute the person. So the Rambam says that we don't take the Gemara literally, but what the Rambam says is that a non-Jew is not allowed to keep any day as a Shabbos. But he also gives a reason. The reason why he's not allowed to is because a non-Jew is not allowed to innovate religion for themselves. You have two doors. You could either be Jewish and have to keep all of the Torah mitzvahs, or you remain a non-Jew, you become what is called a ger toshav, and you accept upon yourselves to keep the seven Noahide laws and all of the other laws that God expects from the rest of humanity. So, based off of this, if the whole rationale is that it's forbidden for a non-Jew to innovate something, then perhaps the avos, the forefathers and their families were different. In source number 11, Rav Asher Weiss, a contemporary Rav and Posek, we've mentioned this, we've mentioned his work a number of times. We spoke about it a few weeks ago about his conceptualization of the principle of rov, of majority. He says, "V'libi omer li, my heart tells me, the ka'asher adam shoves mishum safek, shema Yisrael hu, if this convert, sort of in this intermediary stage, keeps Shabbos, not because he wants to keep Shabbos in general, but because maybe he's a Jew, ein hu bichlal akum sheshavas, then he's not in this category of a non-Jew who's forbidden to rest. Kevin she'ein shvisaso ela mishum mitzvas Yisrael. The whole reason why he's resting is not because he wants to innovate religion, but because on the chance that he's a Jew, he needs to keep Shabbos. Therefore, he's not innovating anything. He's merely trying to fulfill halacha the best way that he believes he needs to do that. And therefore, ein bazeh isur klal, then there's no prohibition at all. V'chein legabe ha'avos. And you can make the same argument for the avos. You can make the same argument for Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. The reason why they kept Shabbos was not because they were non-Jews and they wanted to keep Shabbos, but rather because they had, since the Torah wasn't given yet, they had voluntarily accepted upon themselves the status of being Jewish. They had essentially volunteered to be Jewish. So they weren't non-Jews that wanted to keep Shabbos. He said these were people that accepted upon themselves to be Jews. They weren't halachically Jewish because the Torah wasn't given yet. But Avram, Yitzchak, Yaakov, Sarah, Rivka, Rachel, and Leah, because they acted as Jews. They considered themselves to be Jews. Their observance of Shabbos did not constitute an innovation of religion. And so therefore, Rav Asher Weiss has a lot of practical ramifications in terms of the conversion process, in terms of teaching them Torah, in terms of their Shabbos observance. And so in our case of this convert, it's very possible that he would be allowed to keep Shabbos according to everybody, because he's not innovating religion, according to the Rambam. He's doing it because this is what a Jew is supposed to do. And he's in the process of becoming a Jew, and maybe he is a Jew now, maybe not. So out of suffix, out of doubt, there wouldn't be a problem of this Moroccan convert keeping Shabbos. And similarly, the Avo, similarly the forefathers, there wouldn't be a problem of them keeping Shabbos, because even though they weren't halachically Jewish, they had accepted upon themselves a voluntary status of being Jewish. And as we see, Rav Asher Weiss actually brings a proof for this from an earlier source, Reb Chaim Soloveitchik, the Rav's grandfather, in one small piece that he has on this topic. He says, Mevuar bidvarav, it's clear from the Rambam, Dehaiser shel Shabbos etzel akum, humishum she'aser lo lechadesh das, that the whole prohibition is innovation of religion, v'la'asos mitzvah la'atzmo, and to create a new mitzvah. V'hinei nechzei anan gabei ha'avos. So now let's talk about the forefathers. Im hayakvar aleihen shem Yisrael, whether they had the status of Jews. V'danu ze mevur mekama makomos. And he brings a number of sources. We don't have time to go through all of them. But he says, umikol ze muchach. And he said, and from the totality of Jewish rabbinic literature, it's clear. De'bechefza hayu aleihem shem Yisrael, ela de'bedin hayadin ben Noach. He says they weren't halachically Jewish. They didn't have the din of the Yisrael. They didn't have the ruling, the status, halachically, legally, as Jews. But their essence, the essence of the forefathers and their family, they were Jewish. Their body, what they stood for, their chefza, their very essence were Jews, but that essence had not been realized into a legal reality. Ulefi zeh, and therefore Reb Chaim argues, nira delo shayich kvar lomar dahaya alehen din akum sheshavas. They did not have the status of the prohibition of Gentiles resting on Shabbos. Mikevan debechefza hayu kvar Yisrael. Behem shayachem leShabbos. Jews are intrinsically connected to Shabbos. And so therefore, even though these people weren't halachically Jews yet, because the forefathers and the pre-Matan Torah, the pre-Sinai world of the Jewish people were in essence Jewish, but not legally Jewish, they still had a connection to Shabbos, and they were still allowed to keep Shabbos, and that did not constitute an innovation of religion. And this is a very interesting formulation, which hopefully we'll keep within our minds for the next few weeks as we finish up this topic, that a very interesting way to formulate it is that they were in this intermediary stage. The pre-Sinai Jewish world, even though they weren't halachically Jewish, they were still in essence Jewish. There was almost this genetic Jewishness, if you will. Their neshamos, their souls were Jewish, but they weren't legally Jewish yet. And this can actually begin to answer the question, which I hope to talk about next week, which is, if the Jewish people were really only Jewish after Matan Torah, after they got the Torah, then why do we care about the Avos? Why do we care about Avram, Yitzchak, Yaakov, Sarah, Rivka, Rachel, Leah? Why do we care about them? There were other righteous people in human history before Matan Torah. Noach, Shem, Aver, all of these people were very righteous people, but we don't care about them that much. We care about the Avos. We care about Avraham, Yitzchak, Yaakov, Sarah, Rivka, Rachel, Leah. We care about them. And the reason is that even though they weren't legally Jewish, they were still intrinsically Jewish, and somehow that has an impact on us, even to this day. So that's the end of the discussion about this, how the Avos kept Shabbos. And up until about, I would say, 5-10 years ago, That's also how the story of the convert case, that Moroccan convert from Yerushalayim, would end. Yeah, it took around a year. Rav Asher Lemel was sort of shot down by the mainstream halachic consensus of that day, where they basically said, yeah, even though the sources seem to indicate that you're right, that a person that hasn't immersed themselves yet is not allowed to keep Shabbos, nevertheless, that's not what's done. And the presumable rationale is because even though they're not fully Jewish, they're still somewhat Jewish. And that intermediary Jewish stage allows them, or perhaps even obligates them, to keep Shabbos. But there is one troubling question, a historical troubling question, in source number 13. This is an article that was published on the Sfarim blog, which is a very interesting website. I encourage you all to take a look at it, about just Jewish academia. This was written by a rabbi from Toronto. His name was Rabbi Yirmiyah Malevsky. And he asked a question. He said, what brought this Moroccan to Jerusalem? And what prevented him from converting in his homeland, where he's a very significant population, Jewish population, and rabbinic court was present? Up until the founding of the State of Israel, there was a tremendous Jewish population in Morocco, a very learned one with the Jewish court that it could accept converts. And so this Rabbi Malevsky was bothered, why would this non-Jewish Moroccan travel to Yerushalayim to convert? And he said he read an article about a man named Warder Cresson, who was a fascinating figure. I encourage you all to look him up on the internet. I have a brief article that he quotes. There's a picture of him on page number 8. I'll just summarize who he was. He was he lived in Philadelphia for much of his early life. He was a Quaker in the early 1800s. This was during the Second Great Awakening in America at the beginning of the 19th century, essentially a religious revival movement. And he wrote against materialism and the low spiritual state of contemporary American society. So all of the religious voices that we hear about how bad our generation is, it's not a new phenomenon. People have been talking about it since the 1800s. And he sort of went on this religious quest for just trying to learn more about spirituality and what the correct path was. And he came in contact with two major Jewish personalities in America, in Philadelphia. The first was Rabbi Isaac Lesser, he was the rabbi in Congregation Mikveh Israel in Philadelphia at the time. He also made a very strong connection with a Jewish political leader, Mordecai Emanuel Noah, who actually wanted to create sort of the first Jewish utopia called Ararat as a refuge for Jewish people near in upstate New York, sort of the first Jewish shtetl. And this Warder Cresson, even though he was a Quaker, he became very influenced by these Jewish people, and he wanted to learn more about Judaism. He applied to be the first consul general to Jerusalem in 1844. They took it away eventually, but he made his way to Jerusalem. He saw the ostentatiousness and the praying nature of the missionaries in Yerushalayim, and he decided to convert to Judaism. He subsequently came back he went back to Philadelphia. His wife and kids tried to declare him clinically insane. He divorced them. It became a major, major hullabaloo, famous lawsuit at the time where he sued for power of attorney over his financial assets. Eventually he won and he moved to Yerushalayim and he converted. And on page 9, as you'll see, Cresson or Michael Boaz Yisrael ben Avraham, he converted to Judaism. He married a Sephardi Jewish woman named Rachel Maladano. And what year did he convert? If you look on the third to last paragraph on page 9, it says, I remained in Jerusalem in my former faith, Christianity, until the 28th day of March 1848, when I became fully satisfied that I could never obtain strength and rest, but by doing as Ruth did and saying to her mother-in-law or Naomi, entreat me not to leave thee, for whither thou goest, I will go. In short, upon the 28th day of March, 1848, I was circumcised, entered the Holy Covenant, and became a Jew. The 28th of March is the 23rd of Adar Sheni. That same year, that same day that this Moroccan convert, according to all of our tshuvos, all of our halachic literature, became Jewish. And so what this Rabbi Milevsky posits is that Morocco is a typo. If you switch the Aleph and the Mem at the beginning, Morocco becomes America. It's just no one ever fathomed that you would have this Moroccan, that you would ever have this American, you know, this crazy person from this far-off land that no one's ever heard of in their life, this spiritual desert called America, would come to Yerushalayim. It would be much more plausible to have a Moroccan guy come. But in fact, historically, it seems incontrovertible now that it was not a Moroccan convert. It was actually an American convert, a rather famous one named Warder Cresson. Just something very interesting to keep in mind, how the halachic and the historical process continues to evolve very, very rapidly. And about 5 years ago, we found his kever. We found his burial plot on Har HaZeisim, on the Mount of Olives in Jerusalem. And that's sort of how, I think it was in 2013 that the story broke, and that was how this reevaluation of this famous halachic case came about. So that's the end of our class for today. It was wonderful seeing you all. If anybody has any questions or answers, please feel free to share. Just before that, someone had asked, a couple of people actually had asked me in terms of having access to the recordings of the previous classes. If anybody wants, I can send you links. They're on YU Torah. If you want to search my name or the titles from the classes on the YU Torah website, you can. If you want me to email you the links directly, please email me and I'd be happy to do that. Anyway, if anybody has any questions, comments, please feel free to share.
How do yes, we email you?
No, go ahead, please.
I just want to know your email address.
Okay. Well, it was wonderful to learn with you all, and looking forward.
Wait, hello.
Looking forward
hello.
To seeing you all next week.
Hello. Yes.
I have a question.
All righty. Take care, everyone.
Hello.
Hello. You don't hear us. Hello. You don't hear us.